So Johnny, there were some technical errors last time, so I'll tell you where we were at. We were at, everything was set up. We had four males that rarely ever were with you, and they were with you. And it all started, you said you were, there was the valley, and that's where we left off. And so nobody knows what actually happened to you.
Oh, okay. It's pretty back to the origin. Okay, so there we are in a valley in the Gingee Hills, whatever, about 20 kilometres east of Tiruvannamalai, and we'd already made a camp with the kids up on the hill in this cave, this famous cave up there, and we'd come down to a swimming hole down at the bottom, and where we spent the day swimming that day, and it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and Ginny had taken the bulk of the kids back up to the cave for the afternoon, and I was there with actually all the men and about six kids, and most of them were swimming, but then Zozo and his sister Leia, they'd caught these freshwater crabs, and they were racing them down this mossy incline that the kids had used as a wet slide. So they were racing them down. I mean, the crabs weren't really racing; they were just being carried by the water, really. But it gave an imitation of a race. And the crabs, I remember, were named Compromise and Last Resort. And so I was inspired by the names to commentate their race. So I was sort of beside them, then beside me and them, and I was sort of trying to get ahead of them to see where the crabs were going to race down the bloody thing when I actually stood just over the edge of the thing onto the moss without realising it, and it just really did an incredible slide and bang, landed crash on my hip without, I immediately thought, God, I never felt like that before in my life. I've fallen many times, but I've never broken a bone. But when I fell then, I thought, oh, God, you know. And then I skidded down the incline, this mossy incline, and into another rock. And I think actually I hit the same place again on the rock down there, because there's no other mark on my body where I would have hit anything. It was a big bruise actually around where I hit it. And I lay there in this water with Krishna standing over me going, can you get up, Johnny? And I'm going, well, I don't know, mate. So I sort of lay there. The water was cold, so it felt good, eh? The water was quite cold. And so I lay there in the water quite good, because that felt sort of...
That's supposed to be really good.
Yeah, sort of therapeutic, you know. So then I finally, and Krishna's going, well, we've got to see whether you can walk or not, you know. So anyhow, he levers me up under my feet and props me against a rock. And I have this very distinct feeling that like a puppet with a peg's been pulled out of my hinge. And I just that this just doesn't work, you know. And I think, oh, maybe it's just dislocated, you know, just dislocated, because it wasn't really painful. I mean, it was painful, but it wasn't like, you know, you always hear these stories of when you break a bone that it's like screamingly painful, but it wasn't that painful. It was, you know, it was painful though. So maybe it's not a big deal, and I've just dislocated it. And then I got Andreas, who's with me, who's this Estonian, and he's a healer, he's an acupuncturist, and he's a doctor in his own right, and he felt the bone and where it was hurt and where it wasn't, and he pushed his finger sort of into the thing, and he felt, and he said, I don't think it's dislocated, I think you've broken the neck of the femur, which is where it bends to go into your spine, you know. You got the femur's got a crook on it at the top.
Yeah.
A little crook.
And then there's a ball over.
And between the crook and the thing is what they call the neck. And the neck is where you normally break. That's what Patrick broke when he fell off his bicycle 10 years ago. Anyhow, he said, look, I think that's broken and we've got to get you out of here. And so then it was amazing that everyone ran in circles. Nobody really knew what to do immediately, because it was by then it was 2:30 in the afternoon. We were at least 6 hours from the road, in the forest over some pretty arduous turf, and you know, we didn't really know what we were going to do. So it was good how it worked out. Krishna scooped up the rest of the kids except for Chandani, who stayed with us. His kid, And then he took them back up to the cave where he had phone reception, which was interesting actually, because there'd been a discussion at the school that I shouldn't be taking kids into areas where there was no phone reception, you know. And it turned out that there was good phone reception there. But
you didn't know this before?
Well, I did, but I couldn't assure them, you know. Okay. Couldn't guarantee it. Anyhow, he rang, I think he rang Orpha, and he rang...
He rang Paul, I know.
Paul and Jesse, I think. Maybe he rang three people. And then he came back down, and by that time, he brought down a large plastic tarpaulin, not a large, 3 by 2 meter tarpaulin that I'd brought, and a mass of this polypropylene rope. And and so then with that, and Sandeep cut two pretty great strong poles of wood and lay them on the ground over. They doubled up the tarpaulin, rolled it in the edges towards the middle, and then with the rope they put a zigzag underneath and made this all to sort of Andreas's instruction. And then he strapped a long sort of green stick from my ankle to the top of my hip, and we ripped up an old lungi and he wound it around my hips until it was really tight, and that immediately felt much better. I really started to feel solid.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really started to feel like maybe I could walk on the leg like that, but I tried and actually couldn't. But it made me feel better about it.
Yeah.
And then he strapped on the thigh, and he strapped on the calf, both onto this stick. And so the stick was really firmly, rigidly held. And that was a real asset. I think, but for that, going up that hill in that stretch would have been twice as bloody painful, you know. So then we had to, then finally, about, it's not until really 5 o'clock that we get all that together and get to set out. So we've left poor old Ginny up at the top of the cave with 14 children and no knowledge of how to get out of those hills. She couldn't have got out there on her own. And Krishna hadn't really given her any instruction about what was going on, you know. She didn't know what was going to happen, sort of thing.
What's the distance between the cave and the river?
It's
like a hike wise.
Hike. Oh, it's about half an hour. It's only half an hour.
Okay.
Yeah.
But
it's a pretty hairy hike. You know, there's one point you've got to walk across a log, across a crevasse, and you've got to, you know, there's some very daring bits of stuff there for kids. It's good fun, but it wasn't so much that it was actually knowing the places to turn and go off. A lot of places you could easily go the wrong way on that. If you've got on the riverbed and you don't know where to turn off, you end up with, I know where you end up, and it's not a good place to be. But,
but and that was the first time for Ginny that she was up there?
No, she'd already been up there on a previous, almost equally catastrophic outing where we'd... which I won't go
isn't that now. Your isn't that your signature, Johnny?
That was the first time she got to know me, and she was going, "Oh, I wonder what's going on. What's going on here?" Anyhow, then the thing was then that actually, although Sandeep knows those hills a little, I was the only one who really knew the way back, see, so I had to sort of keep an eye out, and he had to run ahead and find the path and come back and run ahead and find the path. So we had to follow the riverbed then for about 500 metres, and when we got the right turn off, then you had to go through some really arduous bush, but he's thick with thorns, you know.
So who's carrying you at this point?
Well, at this point, no, you've got well, because it's heavier at the front. You've got Andreas and Sandeep carrying the front, and Krishna and Mark carrying the back. And you've got to have four, you know. That was the thing. You couldn't have had three. If one person had to carry the whole of that bloody thing, it would have been so much more difficult. Anyhow, we can only go about 20 metres, because we see a lot of that path also is only wide enough for one person.
Exactly.
And so Krishna had the foresight to bring a cutty down when he came down. And so Sandeep went ahead and slashed back the mulus, and then we'd stop for 20 metres, and then they'd rest, and he'd run ahead and slash and slash and slash and slash, and we'd go on and go on and go on and go on.
But as they're carrying you, then are they kind of clambering on the rocks?
Oh, bloody hell. There were some parts where the rock's so narrow, they had to put the stretcher on top and run over the top and then pull from both sides and then pull from the other sides, and they had to push the stretcher over the top, and every now and then, because my bum was sagging down, we'd hit a rock with the bottom of the bloody thing and bang my bum and stuff. But those guys were in such gruesome pain the whole time that I didn't dare say anything, you know, because they were going, shit, oh, look out, you know. And I was going, oh, God, you guys, I'm sorry what I'm putting you through, you know. And it's getting dark and it's dripping rain, you know. And anyhow, so they get up, they get, I tell you, we got 3 hours. Like, by this, 8 o'clock. 8 o'clock at night after this really arduous thing, and you know how those paths are. You know, they're always about three times longer than you think they are when you've got to cover them in a hurry. And so we get, I reckon, 7/8 of the way up that hill, and actually we just collapsed. Mark and Krishna, they just put down the shutters and said, We can't go on, you know. Look, my hands won't. I mean, I think it was Mark who said his hands won't grip it anymore.
Yeah, that's what he was telling me. It was just like he couldn't close them.
There's
no force.
His hands wouldn't grip. Yeah. And Krishna was also exhausted. And anyhow, but the amazing thing was, it was almost at that instant, because I'd said to Krishna, well, I don't know what you said over the phone, Krishna. Actually, Krishna had been very dramatic over the phone, and so the response had been very dramatic. But I'd said to him, well, I know Paul and Jesse are coming, but I hope they bring a stretcher or something, you know, sort of thing to help us get out of here, because I couldn't. But then suddenly, like I say, the minute these guys collapse and we can hear Paul and Jesse's voice, they've got a very similar voice as those two guys, but they're coming over the hill. I could hear their voices immediately. It was like this incredible synchronization. And almost immediately, Ruslan comes running down the path, because we shout out, you know. He comes running down the path, and within about 10 seconds, with Natasha beside him, with a lantern, but I suppose it was a torch. He's given me a shot of something. He's taken my blood pressure. He's put in a drip, and we're sort of. Then he comes out. They've got this incredible stretcher. It was like Operation Oroville, you know. This big automatic stretcher. There's a clicks under you that clamps together, and strap you in. Totally.
You're
tightly strapped in, so because you've got to get down a slope, you can't slip out of the bloody stretcher, and because your head's at the top, your head's uphill. Because head was uphill coming up the thing, and then they turned me around, and head was uphill going down the thing too, coming down. And
because the first part of the journey you're going up,
yeah,
and then you meet Ruslan, and then there's a big descent.
Well, we're right up here. We meet them just before the top, and actually just before the top it gets really steep. It gets up to about like 60 degrees. You know, it's really incredible. They've got to push this bloody thing up the hill. But there were like 12 guys turn up Angela, I suppose you could say she's a guy now these days. Plus, Natasha and Malvika and Tamar, who's the mothers, who thought, oh shit, if Johnny's not there, we bloody better get up there and give Jeannie a hand or something, you know. Also, at that point, then Andreas and Sandeep turned back and went back, unfortunately, because between them, all of them, they would have worked their way out, you know, I think. They're all pretty essential, actually. Anyhow, so then get to the top of the hill where there's a Durga temple on top of that hill, just where we are, and there's a constant pilgrimage, big night in the Durga temple, there's a constant pilgrimage coming up past us, Om Durga, Om Durga, Om Durga, all these half-naked characters all coming up for this thing. At one point, some old sort of half-naked sadhu starts to bless me with his hands. He put his hands all over me, muttering, Om Durga, Om Durga, Om Durga. I think, oh, I'll get up a walk now, you know, I'll probably be all right. Durga is probably what I need. Anyhow, just then, coming down that hill then, I mean, it would have been fantastic to record the bloody repartee between all these characters carrying it, you know. There was Anand and Noe and Paul and Jesse and this guy Neil and there were three Tamil guys. There were two Tamil guys that worked with Paul. There was Dinesh. There was, I don't know, I must get a list of who these characters are and thank them, but there were 12 of them, which was, well, including Mark and I think there were 12 independent characters, because Paul went immediately into, right now, the way we're going to do this is we're not going to stop. We're going to set their watches at 5-minute intervals, and we'll change positions and shifts every 5 minutes. Every time we'll take a reckoning every 5 minutes, and if you're tired, you change with somebody else, or you change your position. We'll say two in the front, two at the back, and two at the side.
So you can change sides.
Yeah, so nobody's carrying that much, but you're going down such a rocky terrain, And actually going down was a wider path because it's part of this pilgrimage, but you're going down these big steps at some stages, you know. And the steps are sort of giant steps. They're not human steps. They're, for some reason, those temple steps. I don't know why they do that, but you almost need two steps to go up them. If you've got a rucksack, they're very hard to climb, so they're very difficult for the children to climb. And anyhow, so they managed through a lot of hook and crookery to come down that slide till we get to the bottom, and there's at the bottom with Anjali running ahead with a torchlight lighting the way, and everyone seemed to have a very clear role, you know. It was amazing how...
So wait, how long did it take you to get down?
Well, that took another 3 hours. It took 3 hours to get up to get from the thing to the top with the four guys. Initially, and it took another 3 hours to get down the other side, but we had to go pretty slowly down. And there, you know, you get to the bottom, and there's a big puja going on in the little... You don't know those hills here, but right at the bottom there's another little temple where there are roasting goats and all sorts of bloody things going on down there. And so, and they all came racing over and sort of with their cell phones and thought, here's a good photo opportunity.
Selfie.
Here's some old sort of swami that, you know, sort of died on his pilgrimage, or he's been carried up for his last bloody blessing, you know. So they got very excited and wanted to know who I was and, you know, and could they touch me. And
Johnny Swami. Cute.
And there waiting for me is a Aluk in his uniform, you know, his little ambulance driver's uniform.
And the ambulance is there.
Yeah, the ambulance is there with a motor running sort of thing, you know. And you hook the drip up to the roof. It's a very cute little ambulance, you know. And then Paul and Jesse inside the ambulance with me, with Ruslan. And then Ruslan then would say, Ruslan said, now what have we got to decide what we're going to do, Johnny? You know, you got to make clear what did you want to do? And I said, well, what do you reckon, you know? And he said, well, I reckon you're going to need an operation. And he reckoned the best man to do it is this Balachandran at the East Coast. He said, I can telephone him now and tell him what's happening and alert him to the fact that we can send him an x-ray as soon as we get one, and he can tell us whether we need an urgent operation. But sometimes you need to operate immediately. If it's really badly broken, or if it's internal bleeding or something like that, you've got to really... If the skin's broken or if it's internal bleeding, you really got to move fast. And so we then, with a siren going, you know, roaring through the night, it's like sort of a thing. You know, I'm stretched out of the thing with a great big... thing beside me reading my heartbeat, a screen, you know, heartbeat, rate at which I'm absorbing oxygen, sort of state of excitement, you know.
Incredible.
Yeah, very...
psychic tranquility, yeah. Check.
Yeah, very cinematic.
And very professional, no?
Yeah,
I don't know totally. That was the first time the ambulance had been that far.
Or? I don't know. What they see is like everything's looks like we're trying out the system, you know. But even coming down the hill, I was amazed at how everybody seemed to know what they were doing, you know. Like, and it wasn't like you do this or you do that, I'll do this. It was just like it just automatically seemed to happen. But it impressed me just how... you know, it's like when you're with a crew of people who really are synchronized, they work very well together.
And generally a lot of emergencies bring that about, no? Where nobody has to tell anybody what to do. Everybody sort of falls into place.
Yeah,
it's kind of magical.
In particular, if you're working with a gang of Tamils, it's very Tamil. Yeah. You know, they like I see with Rajan, for instance, with Rajan, when he's smelting metal, if something goes wrong, immediately everyone knows what to do without sometimes it ever having happened before, without shouting or you know, jumping on each other or criticizing or something. They all just immediately know what to do, totally silently sometimes. And it's the same on boats too. If you're on a boat, that's what happens with a boat crew. They always know what to do in an emergency. Anyhow, then we get to Jipma.
What time is it now?
It's 2 a.m. I think it's 2 a.m. 2 a.m. you get into Jipma. And we didn't go to casualty. We went into... I just noticed that the thing we went into was called trauma something?
Trauma centre.
Trauma centre. Yeah, look, a relatively new building. But then we went in there and there was an x-ray machine that looked like it was something out of Star Wars. I'd never seen a more classy looking, huge x-ray machine that you sort of slide into, and there's a big screen, and then everyone can look at on the screen, they can look at the thing on the screen, and they give you a digital x-ray that went on to Jesse's cell phone, iPhone. So, and they, I don't even know if they give you a celluloid, you know, but...
And you were telling me last time that this x-ray is just like a photograph of the inside of your body.
Like, well, if you get a chance to look at it, like Paul, Jesse might have it on his phone, but yeah, this looks like the flesh has been opened up and there's the bone. It's like, you can even see the internal tissue of, you know, the way the bone has that internal sort of structure. You can even see that.
You mean like the marrow, I mean that foam?
No,
that
little filaments of how the bone's built. All those little, you know, like you have to see it.
Yeah, tubulars type of.
Yeah. Thing. Yeah. Yeah, like a slice through the bone it is, but you can still see the whole bone. You can see the crack quite clearly. Like immediately they go, oh, right. I mean, there's Ruslan, and they always have a Jibma, even at that time of night. The Jibma hospital at that time of night is still running full speed, you know. Yeah. It's amazing how, I'm always impressed by Jibma as a place to be.
Me too. That place has my utter respect.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Totally. And, anyhow, so the doctor on thing then, he looked at it and he says, yeah, right, man, you're going to need to have an operation on that, like for sure. And I said, well, is it possible to have it here? And he said, well, it is, but the waiting list for that operation will be 3 weeks, I could have definitely nosed my way in there and with a bit of bluster and who I know and get, you know, I could have got in there and had it done, but I felt... He was saying, now look, you guys, you know, you look like you're probably well healed enough to get this done with a private hospital. Why take up our resources, which really are for people who really can't afford it? And so I think he was appealing to us as much as anything. And anyhow, after spending a 1 day waiting for the operation in the East Coast Hospital, I thought, shit, man, I couldn't wait 3 weeks in that state of mind. I mean, they would have put it in traction, I suppose.
Now it must have started hurting, no?
Because it did. It started to... It was just massively uncomfortable. You just couldn't find a place to lie where it wasn't hurting. I like the way... Well, you respect the way Indian hospitals don't heavily give you painkillers, you know? They seem to... The Indian health system seems to believe in pain almost. I don't know what it is, but I've known that right from the early days in the health centres when we used to go and get our tropical ulcers scrubbed out with a coconut brush, you know, by these Tamil nurses. They really think you almost like you deserve what you get, you know. And so I lay there in Pondy, but by this time I had a huge support group in the room with me in a bit to the distress actually of the hospital that we have like. Because it was like Jesse holding forth and a whole big thing going on in the room. I mean, that's what I say, we ended up in the East Coast Hospital. That's where Bala Chen... We sent the x-ray from Jibma then to Bala Chendron on WhatsApp. You know WhatsApp?
Mm-hmm. It's like some free phone calling.
Yeah, some magic thing. We just put the x-ray on WhatsApp and he can look at it. So he writes back, it is about it, but this time it's 3 o'clock in the morning. He writes back, no, there's no need for an immediate operation. I'll see you in the morning at East Coast. He didn't even say to go to East Coast. We did that. I don't know. I don't know if he goes to many different hospitals. I don't know. But we just went to East Coast. But East Coast were very good then. They immediately just put us in a room a bit like this, smaller, but with an attached bathroom and stuff, and tiled up to head height, whole thing tiled, you know, and immaculately clean. Immaculately clean.
So East Coast has been renovated? Or?
Absolutely. Yeah, I remember visiting Patrick there when he broke his thing 10 years ago. And the East Coast Hospital then was a really glamorous foyer. But when you went behind the scenes, it was paint peeling off the bloody roof and even in the operating theatre, you know.
Yeah.
And Paul, I remember Patrick was actually in a corridor. He wasn't even in the general ward. He was in a corridor there, and I had to sort of climb over a few other bodies to get to him and stuff. And I really felt that it was a... rock bottom, buddy, you know, Jesus. And here was I in this really fantastic room with a, you know, although they always have this thing of your first nurses are always these sort of young, sullen ones, you know, who really got no bedside manner at all. until you get one, I suppose, who's a little bit higher or whatever, you finally end up with a really bouncy nurse, you know, who's friendly and speaks a bit of English and quickly picks up your name and wants to, you know, and makes little inquiries and stuff. And so, and there's a funny little guy in the East Coast Hospital who's the superintendent. He's called Adi, and he's about, I suppose he's about 80. And he's just like a little, I don't know if he's an old doctor or what he is, but he's a superintendent. And he comes to see, he would come and see me about every 4 hours and just give me his blessing, so to speak, and good, how are you doing, and very good, you know. And then before you go for the operation, he comes and says good luck and you know, sort of thing.
Sweet.
Yeah, so you have this...
So sort of patient welfare...
Yeah, I mean, after, I don't know, I have such a bad opinion generally of any hospitals, but of my experience, but Jibma, that to suddenly realise that the East Coast is human, I mean, it's not cheap, but it's but it's human. I felt when I was very relieved to finally meet Balachandran, because he's a very affable man. He speaks good English. He not only, you know, he's just a guy who's obviously I'm experienced.
And Ruslan knows him too, right?
Yeah. Now he was Ruslan's, I would say, Ruslan trusts him, and he just done the same operation for a culture about a month or two before. And yeah, everyone, Anne was telling me he did Felix's arm when it was broken, and a lot of people have said, because some of these hospitals have bad reputations with bones, don't they? I mean, Jibma didn't have a very good. Remember Orison when he fell in the lime kiln, he got infected. He had to be flown to Germany, didn't he, to have it
finally,
fixed up?
Finally, because there was always infection in the bone.
Yeah, well, God forgive, you know. Anyhow, so, I mean, then,
after... So they operated on you? You had to wait a whole day and not
I had to,
eat?
Well, you can't eat for 10 hours before the operation in case you vomit. You can't eat or drink for 10 hours before the operation in case you vomit. Because they don't give you a general anesthetic. They didn't give me... They gave you what's called an epidural.
Right.
You know, which is a painful injection.
Yeah, it's in the spine.
Into your spine, yeah. Apparently, well... Jesse looked it up and came and showed it to me. Like in the center of your spine, you've got a whole cord of nerves. And around that is the epidural cavity, it's called. And there's a fluid in there that's protected then by the bone of your spine. So what a deft anaesthetist should do with quite a long needle and strong needle is go between your vertebrae into that epidural cavity without touching the nerve, if he can, but they invariably touch the nerve. And then when they touch the nerve, that's an area that shouldn't be touched. And so when he touched the nerve, in my case, the bloody leg, my left leg, just leapt in the air with an incredible blast of electric shock, you know. And Jesse came over and we Googled it, epidural and electric shock, and they say 4 out of 5, that's what happens. And so nothing to worry about. That's what I didn't want, any nerve damage, you know, because old Sugu's mum went for a rabies shot years ago and got a needle in her stomach from the old rabies shot in Jibma and paralysed her for life. For the rest of her life, she never stood up again. And so, oh no. So a bit wary of anything like that.
I don't see how you can be paralysed. Must have been something with the medication.
No, they hit just a nerve. They hit a nerve somewhere. You know, Clementina, she says, never I have epidural, only I have general anaesthetic. But, I don't know,
how long was this operation?
It felt like, because they give you a sedative as well, and which puts you in a very strange, and I was relating yesterday to Himal, he's had a hernia operation on Thursday. And he had exactly the same thing as me. He had an epidural with an electric shock on his bloody leg. And then they give you a sedative. Now, probably better they don't give you a sedative, because they give you a sedative and sedative doesn't really knock you out. It just makes you a bit stupid. And it puts you in a confused state of mind. Right? All I can remember is my voice saying, could you please explain what's happening? And Himal said exactly the same thing. He said, you know, like you can't work out what's happening, and you just need somebody to stand there and say, right now we're cutting the thing, now we're doing this, now we're drilling that, now that sort of thing, and you get something anyhow. It was only a brief confusion, but you, and the operation took an hour and a half, but it seems to you to take about 15 minutes. It's very short. I mean, you.
And like, you can hear all their noises.
Yeah, you can hear the talking. Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah. That's all right. That's
but sedative makes you feel like it's not really.
No.
You're not involved.
No, well, it's so numb. You know, it's really you have no sense at all. It's only, you know, it could be somebody in the next room building a chair, and so yeah, you do hear the drill. And you know, when I look at the X-ray, because what he implants is a slightly curved plate. This is from titanium, with a pin at an angle, like that on the top, and he has to get that angle right. You know, because if it, you can imagine if because then he screws that plate to your leg.
To the fat part of the bone.
Yeah, it has to go right up into the top of the ball. And if he gets that angle wrong, then your leg's at a bit of an angle in future, you know.
Jesus Christ.
So, oh, no.
It's really carpentry on top of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I kept saying, oh, Pim could do this. Could have bought the rechargeable drill. I would like to see the quality of the drill they use. Is it a sort of a spotless stainless steel sort of surgical drill?
Or just a
Sanyo rechargeable? Yeah. Yeah.
Shit. So then they put in titanium pins and
four screws.
And four screws.
Okay. Yeah. And Balachandran, he says to me, "You know, this will go into the soil with you." So the thing is, but he said it as if I was going to go into the soil next week. You know. Because everyone normally, you know, Patrick had to have his taken out after a year.
Why did Patrick have? Is that not customary, or they generally?
I don't
take
know.
It out?
I don't know really. Because the thing is that when they went to take Patrick's out, the bone had grown completely over it. You know, so you'd imagine that it's strong. It's stronger. As long as your body's accepting it. Apparently, there's a 7% rejection of implants, and. But I don't know. Anyhow, he seemed to be reassuring me that this thing could stay in my body the rest of my whatever estimated life it should be, sort of thing.
And what's the verdict now? So you've been in Sante for about a week, 10 days?
2 weeks, exactly. No, more than 2 weeks now. The operation was on a Saturday night. I stayed 2 days after 2 days in East Coast, Balachandran came in and with one of these walking frames and said, "Well, if you can walk across this room, you can leave the hospital." I said, "Really? After 2 days?" Yeah. So I got up and suddenly realized I could put some weight on the bone then. And so then, you know, then of course you get wheeled into this incredible bloody opportunity in Sante, which is, looks like it's been custom made for just this. I mean, that's what I mean about my sacrifice.
I understood, and I think you were the right person to listen
it. Yeah, no, I know. I mean, it's slight discomfort involved, but
it was a good sacrifice.
Yeah.
And at least it was a bigger thing than, like you said, you were saying, a finger thing, you know. I mean, it was a. It was enough that it involved
right, exactly.
Everybody.
Yeah, not,
really,
not,
everybody
not,
can play
not
their
just
role.
In here with a cough and a cold.
Hangnail.
No.
So how long are you going to be here?
I don't know. I keep prolonging it. I'm so comfortable here. But, Andreas actually said to me, minimum a bone takes to re-heal is 3 weeks. And this isn't what you might call a compound fracture. It's broken all the way through, but it's not displaced at all, you know?
Okay.
It's there, a little bit open,
yeah.
You can see on the X-ray,
yeah.
but not, you know?
Yeah.
And so I imagine it would heal quite fast, a structure like, it's like a crack, really, more than a break. And so 3 weeks is up next Saturday. So I was going to try and come out on Wednesday this week, and I'm already putting weight on it here now, sort of when I work. But I just think by Saturday, I'll probably almost be able to do away with this walking frame, and well, at least with a, maybe with a crutch or something I can.
But don't do what Gopi did, like jumping around too fast.
Yeah, well, a few people have warned me against that. You know, you get on one hand, you get people saying, "Come on, get back on your feet." On the other hand, you get people like Susie's here saying she had a friend called Marcus. I don't know if he's a Orwellian or not, but who got back on his feet after 3 weeks doing something like this, and you get a permanent limp. That's the problem.
Yeah, it's just worth hanging around for another 2 weeks, not doing much.
Not about 2 weeks here, but I think I can. I think that after by the end of this week here, I'm okay here, but I think Saturday I can sort of hobble home, and I'll stay in the demountable on the ground level. And even though just sit in the courtyard there with my leg up, you know, I mean, it can be. I think I'd be likely to move a bit more, with a little bit of the assurance that the bone is pretty well healed. If on Saturday I still feel shit, I can't put too much weight on this bone yet, I'll stay a bit longer. But I don't know. It feels to me, you know, today, that.
It's getting better, but you should just still take it easy, or maybe go somewhere like Jesse and Jyotish's place, if that's not hard, if you think.
Yeah,
Pat and
Hardy up at their place.
Because I don't think you can hop up and down the composting toilet at your
place. No, I can't do that.
So, you know.
Yeah, but yeah.
And it's just, if it's 2 more weeks and that makes a whole big difference on everything else, the whole healing time, I really think it's smart to give yourself that time.
Yeah, no, that's what a sort of wisdom.
But it's amazing that the bone can re-knit in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
I would have thought it took minimum 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So that's really.
Well, they say 4 to 6 weeks you'd be back on your bicycle, sort of thing, you know.
Incredible.
But Patrick's saying he's took much longer than mine. He's surprised how fast mine's healing. But he said he didn't go in for any physiotherapy or anything. He just lay there and hoped it would heal, you know. But
no, I think that's important, the physio. And Clementine has helped.
Clementine's good. Okay. Yeah, she's you know, you feel confident that she knows what she's doing. That's what's what you need to feel. I mean, they did bring a real professional physio from Pondy, but she felt to me a little bit of a taskmaster. And I don't know if I need to suffer too much to heal, you know. There they are.
Well, Johnny, that's really an incredible tale, and I know that everybody will be excited to hear about every detail, and we're all looking forward to you back on your cycle and leading other camps and adventures.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's important to heal properly.
Absolutely.
Because
I'm going to break it again.
Exactly.